You're listening to Food Integrity Now with your host, Carol Gervais. Hello and welcome to Food Integrity Now. I'm Carol Gervais, your host today. At Food Integrity Now, we envision a healthy, sustainable world. A world where our food is nourishing and our mind, body, and spirit can thrive. If you share this vision, go to our website and join us.
Our show today is brought to you by Biolumina Spirulina, one of the finest whole food supplements on the planet. To find out more if this product is right for you, go to www.newphoenixrising.com/beingwell. Or just click on the link on the show page.
My guest today is Dr. Steven Sinatra. Dr. Sinatra is a board-certified cardiologist, nutritionist, and anti-aging specialist specializing in integrative medicine. He has written or co-authored many books, but today we're going to be talking with him about his book he co-authored with Dr. Johnny Bowden, The Great Cholesterol Myth, and their new book, The Great Cholesterol Myth Cookbook. We also wanted to have him on the show today to talk about the recent new guidelines, which were released just recently by the American Heart Association and the American College of Cardiology, that could literally double the number of Americans taking statins from 36 million to 72 million people.
Dr. Sinatra, welcome to Food Integrity Now.
Hey, it's great to be here.
Well, I'm excited to have you on the show today and discuss all these interesting new developments with cholesterol and statins and such. And in your book, The Great Cholesterol Myth, you talk about that the cholesterol has really been given a bad rap and that it's not the most important measure of someone's risk for heart disease. Why is that not true?
Well, I mean, you know, if you look at this cholesterol theory of heart disease, it took really decades to evolve. And in the book, we gave the history. You know, it sort of started off with Eisenhower, Ike getting a heart attack, and then, you know, basically the McGovern administration under Nixon. They were in charge of a committee to look at, you know, nutrition in America. And because a lot of the GIs were coming back from World War II who developed heart disease, you know, heart disease was starting to increase, and they were trying to find the reason. And then they looked at some of the research by Ansel Keys, which was very, very questionable. And then the McGovern Committee started to steamroll, and they thought that, you know, maybe because of all the fats that, you know, Eisenhower ate and some of the GIs ate, that, you know, the cholesterol and the butter and the eggs and the meat was a factor. And it decided to go along with it, especially since Ansel Keys came out with this data showing that countries eating the most fats had the most heart disease. However, he cherry-picked six countries out of 22, and he had this linear graph when he had countries of omission. And if you include all the 22 countries, then there was no correlation between saturated fat and heart disease. So in the final, at the end of the day, what happened was is that saturated fats, because they are sort of, you know, metabolized into cholesterol in the body, that took a big hit. And then for years, butter was a taboo, eggs were a taboo. Then we switched to margarine, which was the biggest disaster we've ever seen in the cardiological community, because margarine was pure trans fats. And then with the advent of margarine, the incidence of coronary artery disease skyrocketed. So basically, what happened was saturated fat became vilified. We went to margarine. That was, you know, 100 times worse. We created this monster in America called hypercholesterolemia, and then we had to develop drugs to neutralize this problem. So that's how it got started, and it is a myth. I mean, I will tell you this. I mean, cholesterol is found at the scene of a crime, you know, with a heart attack, but it's not the perpetrator. I mean, it's one small piece of the inflammatory puzzle. It does contribute, but not as much as you would think, you know, the TV would make you believe.
Right. So let's talk about cholesterol. What exactly is cholesterol?
Well, it's a substance that the body produces. You know, we call it a waxy substance. It lubricates the skin. It's needed for life. I mean, we have to have it. I mean, it's the basis of our bile salts. We need it for digestion. It's the basis for multiple hormones in our body, including DHEA, our sex hormones. When the sunlight hits our skin, cholesterol in the skin forms vitamin D. Cholesterol is a huge part of our brain because our brain is mostly fat, and we need cholesterol for neurotransmission of impulses. So we need cholesterol. I mean, it's a very, very important substance in our body. If you look at a lot of the data, whether you look at the European literature or the American studies, we know that the higher your cholesterol, the more protection you have from infectious disease, which is very interesting because, you know, kids with, you know, methicillin-resistant staph have greater protection with higher cholesterols. Adults with respiratory illness or even gastrointestinal infections have a much higher resistance with higher cholesterols. And I read about this the other day on a plane in Scientific American. Years ago, when man developed, we used to have a genotype called the APOL4 allele, which manufactured more cholesterol genetically to protect early man and even, you know, mankind in the last 500 years against infections. So cholesterol has always been a genetic deterrent for infections. And again, there is data to show that people in Italy, as well as the Framingham study in America, that the higher your cholesterol, the longer you may live. So, you know, cholesterol got a bad rap, and unfortunately it's still getting that bad press.
So you and many other professionals believe that this emphasis on cholesterol has caused us to take our attention away from what are the true promoters of heart disease. So what do you feel those promoters are?
Well, I mean, certainly the most important promoters of coronary disease right now in this country would include trans fats, you know, the margarines, the oils that we cook in, you know, over and over again, like for French fries are cooked in, for example. But more than that, what scares me even more than the trans fats, because the FDA is doing a good job of educating the public and getting those out of, you know, foods, because the partially hydrogenated fats are great preservatives, but they're killers to the body. But what scares me even more is the sugar in this country. I mean, the average person is eating about 160 grams of sugar per, I mean, 160 pounds of sugar per year. So, you know, when I was a kid, when I got a cola, it was in a 6.5 ounce bottle. So when I drank a bottle of cola for 10 cents, I got 5 teaspoons of sugar, which was a lot, but, you know, it was 5 teaspoons. Now a child of a similar age can go into a fast food restaurant, get 32 ounces or even 64 ounces, and be taking in 50 to 55 teaspoons of sugar, you know, at one meal. So it would be like 10 times the amount I took in as a child. So what we're seeing today is we're seeing insulin resistance and type 2 diabetes in a lot of children, overweight status in children. And what's happening is that we are creating a generation of metabolic syndrome or type 2 diabetes, which is highly inflammatory. And it sets the stage for inflammation, which sets the stage for coronary disease. So I just feel that we've gotten off the mark. We've chose the wrong marker. I mean, again, cholesterol, when it becomes oxidized, becomes inflammatory. What will oxidize cholesterol will certainly surges of insulin, sugar, you know, certainly, you know, high sugar in the blood can mix with proteins. We call it age glycated products, which are inflammatory. You know, certainly emotional stress can contribute to the picture as well. So, you know, when we look at heart disease, you know, we have to look at sugar. We have to look at emotional stress. We have to look at trans fats. But and then there's other things in the environment that have cropped up over the last few decades, and that includes, you know, the heavy metals, the mercury, the lead, the EMF, the radio frequency waves, which can cause inflammation and damage DNA. Even pharmaceutical drugs can deplete vital nutrients out of the body. The classic one is statins and CoQ10. So we have a lot of factors that can contribute to heart disease. When I wrote the book Reverse Heart Disease Now in 2007, I called it toxic blood syndrome, and I called it the Dirty Dozen risk factors. And cholesterol was not even on my list back then. So even back then, I was sort of, an anti-cholesterol individual.
So many people may not consider sugar to be something that causes inflammation. Can you explain that a little bit?
Well, people want to equilibrate sugar with inflammation, but what sugar does is, and I'm not just talking about the sugar you put in your tea and coffee. I'm talking about the sugar that's pervasive in processed foods. So if people are eating a lot of crackers, cakes, brownies, bagel, gluten-free foods, wheat, breads, pastas, lots of potatoes, rice. Rice has a really high glycemic load, even greater than potatoes. But like, if you're eating these white foods, and especially the white flours, you're getting foods that really are sugar, that turned into sugar in the body. And if those foods aren't balanced enough with healthy fats and proteins, you get an overzealous insulin response where you need to manufacture insulin from the pancreas to help to metabolize the sugar. And what happens is that the sugar is not metabolized because we're taking in too much. The pancreas is putting out surges of insulin, and these surges of insulin are what we call endothelial cell unfriendly, and basically they cause oxidative stress or irritation or inflammation of the smaller blood vessels. So what sugar does, it elicits hormonal responses that can cause inflammation, and people don't realize that. So diet is really one of the key factors in preventing heart disease.
Well, that brings me to my next subject I wanted to talk about, the new guidelines that came out a couple of weeks ago with regard to statins and the recommendation that the American Heart Association is recommending. It really upped the ante on, the number of people who could be put on these statin drugs. I mean, right now we have, I think it's 36 million people on statins. I did a little research on this. And with those new guidelines, they could bump that up to, they could double that. So 72 million people in this country on statin drugs.
Yeah, it would be a disaster.
Yeah. And I also took a look at those guidelines and some of the things that they factored in there, and I'll just name those just to educate our audience a little bit. The factors are your age, your sex, your race, your cholesterol number, and that's an overall number, your blood pressure, whether you have diabetes, and if you are a smoker. So those are the factors that they're using to equate this percentage or your risk factor. So let's talk about the overall cholesterol number.
Sure. Years ago, when the guidelines first came out, I believe in 2001, the ATP3 guidelines, what they were trying to do was get the LDL below 130 and then below 100 and then below 70. But guess what? When we drove LDL into the basement, we didn't really see an improvement in longevity. There was an improvement, however, in what we call recurrent cardiac events. But at the end of the day, there really was an improvement in longevity, although the cardiac events were reduced. In other words, people were dying of other factors as well as heart disease, cancer, and it evened it out. So the mousetrap was drive LDL down as far as possible, but it didn't make any difference in longevity. So now we have a new mousetrap. And the new mousetrap basically is, well, how high is your risk? And that was based on, one of the factors was there was a study in Scotland. We called it the West of Scotland study. where if you took a group of Scots who were heavy smokers and you put them on statin drugs, over a period of years, those high-risk men, and these are only men, and a lot of these men had what we call a low HDL, which is a serious risk factor in heart disease. But these men who were smokers who had high risk were put on statins, and they did statistically have much less cardiac events. So basically, what I think is being done is they're basing a lot on this study. And if your risk is like 10% or 7.5%, 7.5% over a 10-year period, they're recommending you take a statin. Now, what I'd rather do is reduce that risk naturally. In other words, if you're overweight, lose weight. If you're a smoker, stop smoking. If you're hypertensive, let's get your blood pressure down. If you're diabetic, let's reverse the diabetes with a healthy diet and targeted nutritional supports and maybe some raw foods thrown in and enzymes and exercise. However, what the associations want you to do is take a statin, which I think is a bad move because I really feel that the problem with statins, and statins do some good things, and maybe we can talk about that later. Statins are a blessing and a curse. But when you're treating primary prevention and risk, I think you're going to be over-treating many people, and you're going to be under-treating the people that need it the most, and maybe I should get into that now.
Okay.
The people that need statins the most, and this is the bright side of statins, is basically men with documented non-occult coronary disease. Men who have, a previous heart attack, a stent, a bypass, an angioplasty. And if these men are under the age of 75, and the reason why I choose 75 is because I don't like to give statins to the elderly. I do believe it interferes with neurotransmitters, and it may hasten the development of mental confusion.
Mm-hmm.
So, but the data does show that this group is a group that has the most to gain and the least to lose. So I would rather see we overutilize that group and underutilize all the other groups in those guidelines. For example, women. Let's take women for example who has coronary disease. As a clinical cardiologist, I've used statins for a couple of decades. I'm unimpressed with the utility of statins in women. I'm not convinced. For either secondary prevention. Now, there are some studies out that are suggesting that in high-risk women, they may make a difference. But my concern in women is the side effect profile. Now, if I had a woman, let's say, who had definite coronary disease, who was getting worse despite, my best efforts, would I use a statin? Sure, I would. I would, in other words. But I'm not using it to lower her cholesterol. I'm using a statin to improve what we call blood viscosity. It makes the blood thinner. I would use a statin as an anti-inflammatory. They are anti-inflammatories. They're also antioxidants, but not to lower cholesterol. I'm using a statin in a different light. The problem with women is that women who are in their 30s and 40s who have high cholesterols and are being treated with statins for prevention. Well, there's data to show that women on 10 years of statins can get more breast cancer than women not taking statins. There's data to show that women can get diabetes on statins. And there's data to show that men and women, get, horrific side effects on statins that can be completely reversible. So it doesn't make sense to treat numbers in these patients or treat cholesterol as the marker. It doesn't make any sense at all because you're trading a serious downside risk. However, like I said, in men with documented disease, they have a lot to gain. And if they do have complications, well, they can go off the drug, but at least, you targeted a population that could get benefit from the drug. So, when I look at these guidelines, and there's four of them out there, I would say they're about 20-25% correct.
Yeah. And what about, I understand they're giving statins to children these days too.
Well, yeah, this is really something that it really does bother me, because what they're targeting here, even with that LDL number of 190, you saw the LDL number of 190 there. What they're targeting is familial hypercholesterolemia. Now, these are people who get dealt a bad set of genes. The worst case scenario, unfortunately, it only occurs in 1 in a million children, is when you get two recessive genes, you've got a problem with LDL receptor sites. And these children's cholesterols go into the high hundreds to 1,000. And unfortunately, they die at an early age, unless they get a liver transplant. Now, if I had a child with that situation, would I give him a statin? Of course I would. To help to block the endogenous production of cholesterol. And it's perfectly reasonable to give that child a statin while they're waiting for a liver transplant, but you're dealing with a million to one shot. Now, let's take the other situation, the less invasive problem, or the less vulnerable problem. You're dealt one gene instead of two. We call that autosomal dominant familial hypercholesterolemia. But the odds of that occurring are like 1 in 400 to 500 people. So in the guidelines, they want to treat people with a LDL number of 190 now. I say if it's familial hypercholesterolemia and you have the genetic profile, it makes sense. But again, are you going to treat everybody with a cholesterol of an LDL of 190? No. Now, will you treat the familial people? Yes, I would treat those people. But again, you're talking about maybe 3 or 4 million people in the country, as opposed to, tens of millions with cholesterols of LDLs greater than 190. So I have a problem with that guideline as well. Now, the LDL guideline of the 190, we got to look at that, because these people who have the familial genetic traits, I have seen heart attacks in those families in people less than 50, in both men and women. And I would, and again, if they did have the genetic trait, I would use a statin if it was a man or a woman as prevention. But I have to tell you this, I've seen people with those familial cholesterol traits of 300 and 400 and 500 cholesterols and above, and live into their 80s and 90s as well. So, if you have that familial hypercholesterolemia, and you make it into your 60s with no previous history of heart disease, you can expect to have a decent longevity. And remember, like I said before, when you have high cholesterol numbers, it protects you from other ailments, particularly infections. So, again, when cholesterol is high, it can be a bright side. It also, remember, high cholesterols protect you from hemorrhagic stroke. Not from what we call thrombotic stroke, but from hemorrhagic stroke. So there's something about a high cholesterol number that is beneficial in the body.
Well, it's interesting. I am close to, or I am 60. I had a hard time saying that because I turned 60 this year. Just caught myself. That's funny. Anyway, I had been diagnosed, oh, probably 15 years ago with the high cholesterol. And, my overall number was close to 300. And I am 5'8" and lean, and I eat healthy, I exercise. And the doctors wanted to put me on Lipitor or whatever the current drug was back then. And I just intuitively knew, that this was not the thing to do. And I actually have never had my cholesterol checked since then, nor have I had any indication of any kind of heart disease.
Well, you did the right thing. You followed your intuition. I mean, that was very smart. I mean, there's lots of people out there like yourself, particularly women, who would see me in the office, and they've even went to universities here in Connecticut. I mean, and these women were told that they must take cholesterol-lowering drugs or else they were going to die. And they were like you. They would come into my office, and they'd have high cholesterols, And basically, you know, what would I would do, what did I do? Well, basically, I took them off their cholesterol lowering drugs, and they would cry and they would hug me, and because again, do you want to resort a woman in their late 20s and 30s to decades of statin drugs when they can cause enormous harm and cause biochemistry over time? And so anyway, these guidelines are confusing. They will overtreat a lot of people.
They'll sell a lot of drugs too.
And they'll sell a lot of drugs. If they overtreat the population that needs it the most, that's okay. That's okay, because those people will get benefit. But I'll be writing an editorial in for the American College of Nutrition on this. And you know, there's strong opinions for the opponents and the proponents of the cholesterol theory, and it gets a little bit of it gets highly charged. I have to tell you that at the conferences I've been at. But in the end of the day, what a doctor has to do is listen to their patient. And if the patient is talking about side effects, the doctor really has to listen and honor the side effects, because unfortunately, a lot of the side effects are being swept under the carpet. And patients are being told that, oh, you're just getting older, you know, everybody forgets their keys and their glasses, you know, oh, your eyesight's get off because you're older, you're a little bit of fatigued because you're older, you can't play doubles tennis because, again, you're getting older. That's what my patients have told me, that other doctors have told them. So it's just important to honor the patient's feelings, because again, these drugs, when used appropriately, in the right population can be a blessing, but in the wrong population can be an awful curse.
So let's talk about some of the risks of taking statins. What are some of those risks?
Well, the major risk is that they deplete CoQ10 in the body. They also deplete squalene, which is very important for a woman's immunity. And when you deplete, you know, CoQ10, you also can harm the immune system.
Mm-hmm.
But remember, CoQ10 is very important for muscle activation, whether it's your heart muscle or whether it's your skeletal muscle. And CoQ10 is very vital for energy in the body. So when CoQ10 stores get depleted, I mean, these people can have a lack of energy, a fatigue component. They certainly can have muscle aches. We call that myalgias or pains. And these are the most common side effects of statins, are easy fatigability, muscle pain, and muscle weakness. And I would suspect that a lot of this is due to the lowering of CoQ10 in the body, because remember, when you interrupt these biochemical pathways, CoQ10 shares the same pathway as cholesterol.
Oh, it does. Huh. I never knew that.
Oh, yeah, exact same pathway. And then the other side effects, you can have nerve pain, you can have GI problems, liver problems, respiratory problems. I mean, there's so many problems you can have with statin drugs. Memory is a big problem. You know, and I mean, people have lost total memories on statins. We call it total global amnesia. So there's a lot of factors that people need to be aware of when they take a statin.
Which is why I'm really concerned about these new guidelines, because like you said, you know, maybe we'll get a few more people healthy that, you know, are at high risk. But what about the people who really aren't at high risk that are going to be taking, you know, these drugs that have so many side effects that, you know, it could create an epidemic of different issues?
Sure, and that's the problem. We don't want to overtreat people who do not need statins, and you know, it's hard for a physician to determine, oh, you at high risk, and if high risk is a standard of care, and that's the problem. The physician may say, oh, geez, I don't want to, you know, I want to, you know, correspond to the standard of care, but it's going to be hard for health professionals to cipher out, well, who's at high risk, low risk, medium risk, you know? I mean, so this is sort of a hodgepodge, and this is a very, very dark gray area that physicians really need to hone in on, because if they treat the right person, like a middle-aged male with coronary disease, they've done a good thing. But if they treat the wrong person, a cholesterol number, and a person, you know, ends up having a serious complication, they've caused harm. So, you know, the essence of medicine is, you know, first of all, do no harm. But however, if the standard of care is that, sometimes it forces the physician to go the other way. So, you know, especially with medical legal situations in the country, sometimes it's tough for these physicians to go one way or the other. I know I've been there. Because remember, when I was chief of cardiology at my institution years ago, I believed in a cholesterol theory. I was a real cholesterol choir boy. I used to lecture for drug companies on cholesterol. But I had a complete turnaround back in 1993. So, and the reason why I turned around, and that's one of the reasons why we wrote the book, is that there was an article that came out that statin drugs inhibited CoQ10. And I don't know if you know this, but I've been using CoQ10 for over three decades. I've been using it since 1982, and it's been a lifesaver in my patients. And when I realized that CoQ10 was being knocked off by statin drugs, I realized that how could a drug be so good if it's killing the very nutrient that the heart relies on? So I stopped using statin drugs routinely in the early 90s, and then only started to use them again when I realized that in males with coronary disease, they had less subsequent cardiovascular events. So I became very, very selective with statins, and you know, those are the same things I said on other media programs, and I haven't really wavered. The only way that I might be wavering in the future is with this West of Scotland study, which I commented on before. You know, if I had a high-risk male, hypertensive, stressed out, low HDL, overweight status, couldn't reduce his risk, would I use a low-dose statin in him? You know, based on the West of Scotland study, which I thought was a very, very good study, I might go that way and, you know, give a very, very low-dose statin with coenzyme Q10 as a chaser.
Okay. And what other supplements do you recommend as being good for those listeners who really want to prevent heart disease?
Well, I mean, that's a great question. I mean, you know, be a load of supplements. I mean, what I like is a standard good vitamin and mineral formula. I like the Awesome Foursome. That's metabolic cardiology. I like the combination of Q10, carnitine, ribose, and magnesium, because they all help to generate ATP. I certainly like omega-3. I mean, omega-3, you know, actually supports heart rate variability. It prevents sudden death. It's really vital in our environment now because we're getting too many inflammatory omega-6s. You know, we're ingesting too many corn oils and canola oils and soybean oils and cottonseed oils. So they are, you know, pro-inflammatory. So the omega-3s are anti-inflammatory. So, you know, I like omega-3. When it comes to raising HDL and lowering triglycerides, which I think is a huge factor in overweight people.
Yeah, let's talk about the triglycerides. That was going to be one of my next questions.
Yeah, well, the high triglycerides will respond to, you know, a lower carbohydrate diet, especially sugars. You take sugars out of your diet. But it'll also respond to omega-3s. But the one ingredient that I really like for high triglycerides and low HDL and even higher blood sugar is citrus bergamot. That's sort of a citrus, what we call flavonoid, bioflavonoid. It comes out of Italy, mostly Calabria. It's about a 4-foot plant, and it has the citric bioflavonoids that lower blood sugar, lower triglycerides and raise HDL. So to me, that's a trifecta of protecting cardiovascular health, because remember that triglycerides can be highly inflammatory and set the stage for inflammation as well. So I like citrus bergamot.
And where can people find out more about that or get that?
It's on my website. It's on heartmdinstitute.com. That's an informational website. It's on drsinatra.com. That's my e-commerce website. People can probably go to health food stores and ask, you know, the health food store manager about citrus bergamot. I've been using it for a couple of years. I like it. I've had good reports from patients. It actually works like a low dose statin, but it doesn't give you the side effects of statins. It's kind of interesting in its mechanism of action. But I love what it does to triglycerides, HDL, and blood sugar. And people, there's also been anecdotal cases where people take it for a long term, 6 months to a year, because of its impact on blood sugar. There's also been weight reduction as well.
Wow, wonderful. Well, I will check that out also.
It's in our book. It's in the latest book, The Great Cholesterol Myth Cookbook. We mentioned it in The Great Cholesterol Myth. I expanded it on The Great Cholesterol Myth Cookbook. We had another year to really look at the cholesterol theory, and I changed some aspects about fluffy LDL and fractionization of LDL. So the Great Cholesterol Myth is a little Myth Cookbook is a little bit updated on the Great Cholesterol Myth, and then we include some nice recipes, you know, the coconut recipes, the avocados, and stuff like that.
Yeah, I have it here, and it's really got some wonderful recipes. So what do you feel are the five biggest enemies, food-wise, to your heart?
I would say the trans fats, number one. You know, just stay away from them. If people read labels, and the label says zero trans fat, but it says partially hydrogenated, you know, cottonseed, canola, soybean oil, just, you know, put it down. Because remember, if you have two or three servings of it, you're going to get trans fats, you know. So, you know, trans fats have got to be out. You know, would I be cooking, eating fish and chips once a week? No, I wouldn't be doing that. You know, deep fried fruits, because even if you use saturated fats, the overcooking of these fats can sometimes, you know, generate, you know, chemicals that can be harmful to the body.
You're talking about smoke points, right?
Yeah, smoke point. Yeah, but even when people eat a lot of French fries with the acrylamide, it's a carcinogen. And basically, when you overcook these oils, you almost put them into a trans fat direction. You know, you change the architecture by constantly overcooking. I mean, can you cook in olive oil? You know, you can probably cook in a light olive oil because it has a higher smoke point, but I'd rather see people cook in coconut oil, than the saturated fat. I would really rather them see. I wouldn't want them cooking in the omega-6 oils like the canola oils. I don't want people to use the omega-6 oils.
Right.
We get enough of it as preservatives.
You know, and what about, while we're talking about fats, how do you feel about pasture butter, which is what I use? I use pasture butter, olive oil, and coconut oil, basically.
What are they, plant sterols? Is that what it is?
Pasture
or is it
butter?
Is it butter?
Pasture butter is 100% grass-fed. It's from grass-fed cows.
Oh, it's butter. It's organic butter.
It's organic butter, grass-fed cows.
Oh, that's fine.
Yeah.
That's absolutely fine. In fact, I'm glad you mentioned that because, remember, butter is a concentrate. So butter is one item you want to have organic. You really want to have organic and grass-fed if possible because, remember, if you're getting butters from cows given bovine growth hormone, you're going to get concentrates of that. So I'm glad you brought that point up. Organic butter, grass-fed butter is the best butter.
Right. And olive oil, I did a show with Tom Muller, who wrote the book Extra Virginity, The Sublime and Scandalous World of Olive Oil. And there's a lot of olive oil out there that is not truly extra virgin olive oil, which extra virgin olive oil means it's just fresh squeezed olive juice. That's it. Not processed or anything. You know, I always caution people, if you're buying your grocery store bulk olive oil, I'm not sure that's what you're getting because the FDA does not regulate it.
Right. Yeah. I mean, olive oil, you got to be very careful. In fact, you know, a lot of people are buying the California olive oils because the California olive oils appear to be 100%. If the label is at least 75% olive oil from Europe, they can call it extra virgin olive oil.
Right.
And that can be cut with canola oil. So, you know, there is a problem, no doubt about it.
Yeah, and it can also be processed too. So
right.
Besides, we were talking about the five biggest enemies to heart disease, and you talked about trans fat. What else?
Well, sugar, sodas would be number two. That would be my, that is a horrible thing to put in your body, whether it's a diet soda or a regular soda. I mean, the regular soda is going to have the high fructose corn syrups, and I would just say that they bring nothing to the table. Mm-hmm. I mean, my kids grew up with no soda. Nobody drinks soda in my house, you know. And they used to complain for years, but now, and all three of them in the medical field, by the way, and they've always thanked me for that.
I think
out of the house.
I think diet soda is worse because of the aspartame in it.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Yeah. My third thing would be I would go with sherbet, being a really bad type of sweets, because again, it's pure sugar. It's going to get an enormous insulin response. You know, if somebody wanted to eat, let's say, an organic ice cream or a gelato that's made with egg, that would be fine with me. You know, you have sugar in it. I mean, I'm not going to vilify all sugars. We can't take away all our pleasures, you know. But that would be a substitute. Because remember, when you have ice cream, you got fat and you got protein in it. And that's going to balance the insulin response to a degree. Because when you combine fats and proteins with sugar, it's going to help to balance the overzealous secretion of insulin, you know, to the sweeteners.
I think the key in the ice cream situation, though, is that buy organic, because when you look at some of the ingredients in some of the ice cream where they have the word natural flavors, that can be number of things, including Food Babe, who's another food activist that does wonderful investigations about food, discovered that some of these natural flavors they're using in products like ice cream they use the beaver butts.
The who?
I know, it sounds crazy. Beaver butt. They use the renal glands of beavers because the flavor tastes very much like vanilla. So, and it's cheaper to use. And, our listeners can research this. I'm not making this up. So I would just caution you, if you're going to have your ice cream with the sugar in it and stuff, go organic.
All right. That sounds good.
Okay. What else?
Let me ask you about Breyers ice cream.
I don't know about Breyers.
Breyers has always been sort of not an organic, but a natural cream. I mean, if you read the label, you don't need a PhD degree to figure it out, you know?
Okay, yeah. Well,
check that. Do me a favor. Check that for both of us. And email Joanne, you know, the person you scheduled the radio with. But you know, that would be good.
Yeah, I'll let you know about that. And I'll post that. I'll let our listeners know about that, too. So anything else food-wise that you think is a real problem for heart disease?
Yeah, I would say white chocolate is.
White chocolate.
Yeah, ooh. White chocolate. That would be number four. I think that would be a problem because, again, it's pure sugar. It brings nothing to the table. You know, if you like chocolate, I would go with the cocoa chocolate, the really good stuff, you know.
Yeah, the high percentage of real. Yeah.
Well, you know, a nice, you know, cocoa, 70-80%. At least you're getting the bioflavonoids there that have a favorable aspect on heart disease as opposed to pure white chocolate. I guess my fifth one would be any processed hot dogs, bologna, stuff like that. Processed meats that, have nitrate in it, nitrite in it, preservatives in it. I would probably make that on my fifth list. Now, if you're at a baseball game, you know, you're out watching the Colorado Rockies and you have a hot dog once or twice or three times a year, that's okay, you know. You know, would you have a hot dog once or twice a week? Absolutely not, you know. Because nitrites building up over time, that can be a problem.
Yeah, well, I haven't had a hot dog in 20 years, and I think I can live without them.
You can probably live without them.
I can probably live without them. So what do you think about grains? You talk about this a little bit in the cookbook. Let's talk about that.
I'm sort of out on grains. I am bearish on grains. You know, amaranth is okay.
Quinoa.
Quinoa is okay. Oats, okay. You know, oatmeal is okay with me. You know, of course, oatmeal. I just want to get away from wheat. Wheat is the one that really bothers me. And especially wheat and breads and crackers and bagels and stuff like that. I mean, I think there's much more gluten allergy out there than that we really realize, you know. So I just feel that. And I don't know if you ever had Bill Davis on your show. I mean, he has a great book out there, The Wheat Belly.
Yes, I have.
Bill has done a great job.
Yeah, he has.
He has done a great job, and I believe him. And he's done a lot of research on the genetically engineered wheat. I mean, if you know, the more bread people eat now, the more they want to eat because there are components or genetically engineered substances in these white breads now that make you hungrier when you eat it. So it's no reason why we're seeing all, I mean, I can see the reason why we're seeing all these overweight people, because bread, I'll tell you, if you want to lose weight, the best way of losing weight is just lose the wheat, lose the bread, lose the crackers. And the more you can do that, you know, the more you can do that, the greater poundage you'll shed.
Absolutely. I truly believe that. I'm a health and wellness coach, and that's something I discuss, on the first call with my clients about their grain intake. And I've had a lot of success with people from eliminating it from their diet. So let's summarize. What do you think? I know this is a broad question, but what do you think is the best course of action for a person that doesn't have, a big history of heart disease or doesn't have a lot of risk factors, to stay on course, to kind of mitigate any chance that they might get heart disease? If you had to summarize it up, what would that be?
I mean, you know, it's basically a lifestyle, a good healthy lifestyle. I mean, I would incorporate my six pillars of healing. You know, I've written about this on my website, especially heartmdinstitute.com. I mean, that website is loaded with my six pillars. But, you know, we talked about some of it. I mean, it all starts with diet. I like the Mediterranean Pan-Asian. I call it the PAM diet. And again, that's on the website for, you know, people to really look at. That diet's a non-inflammatory diet. And the most recent Mediterranean diet was using 4 tablespoons of olive oil a day, and they showed really good results. You know, if you ate like a Pan-Asian Mediterranean and you incorporated some seaweeds and some fish, wild fish, although the fish today I'm a little worried about with Fukushima, but that's another conversation.
Yeah, that is. Me too.
You know, some fermented soy I like. Nuts are really healthy for you, and that's on the Mediterranean side. Olive oil, you know, flavor your sauces with some meats. That's okay. Don't eat chunks of meats. You know, organic eggs are fine. Fresh fruits and vegetables as the basis and high fiber. You can't go wrong with that. That's a non-inflammatory diet. So I like that. Everybody needs to do some form of exercise, even if it's just walking the dog. It's very, very important. And for seniors, it's the best way of alleviating constipation. That's the best way because you must move your body. You know, taking up yoga and Pilates for seniors, a great way to get back to exercise, recreational sports, golf, you know, doubles tennis, fishing, walking, all that stuff is great. Ballroom dancing. That would be my second, you know, exercise is my second pillar. My third would be detoxification measures. You know, we all need to detox. We have a heavy, heavy burden of toxins in the environment. And it's not just mercury and lead and heavy metals, it's insecticides and pesticides and toxic EMF from cordless phones, cellular phones, cell phone towers, you know, all that stuff has an impact on the body, and it puts a total burden on the body, a toxic burden. So I like detoxification measures. This is why a, you know, a high fiber diet is good. Sweating is good. You get a lot of the chemicals out through your skin by sweating. So I like saunas and, you know, hot yoga is great. I mean, there's so many different ways you can detox the body. Even psyllium seed, taking psyllium seed, you know, a tablespoon a day is great for cleansing the bowel, for example. But it's not rocket science. My fourth pillar is mind-body interactions. Big believer in prayer and meditation, qigong, yoga, silence. Very, very, very important for attenuating the autonomic nervous system. And while I'm on the autonomic nervous system, earthing, grounding, walking barefoot, extraordinarily important in taking in the energy of the earth. My second edition of the earthing book is going to come out in 2014, and I was amazed, absolutely blown away, of the testimonials that people sent in after the first earthing book, how earthing changed their life and basically treated their pain. I mean, I can't believe how many. So we had to keep out stories, or else the book would have been 600-700 pages. But
we're going to have you back on the show at some point to talk about that, because that sounds fascinating.
No, earthing is awesome, awesome. Yeah. And the last thing is targeted nutritional supports. I mean, I really like people to take, you know, vitamins, minerals, herbs. I'm a big believer in, a foundation vitamin and mineral. I like probiotics. I like the omega-3s. You know, I've been generating supplements for, over 20 years. And I strongly believe that even with the healthiest diet you can possibly take in, you're not going to get the vitamin D, the vitamin C, the CoQ10, the zinc, the selenium. You're just not going to get it, especially magnesium. It's not going to be found. And even the folate fortified foods, folate's not going to work in anymore. We need methyl tetrahydrofolate. We need methyl cobalamin. We need pyridoxal 5-phosphate. In other words, we need to upgrade our B vitamins, because the standard B vitamins aren't being available because our body is changing. And I'll tell you this, I think the microsome or the microbiome, gut flora is going to be the field of the future, where this is why I really like probiotics. And at drsinatra.com, we have a great probiotic. I mean, I love it. It's a lactobacillus B299. And what we don't realize as a humankind, we didn't realize this until recently, I'd say in the last 5 years, 10 years maybe, that the human gut is really the most important factor in the immune system. So you must take care of your gut. And Bernard Jensen, I mean, you're a health coach, right? I mean, he said
yes.
It about years ago. You probably read his stuff. Mm-hmm. Death begins in the colon. He was right. He was absolutely right. I strongly believe that, you know, we've had the blood type diets. We've had, you know, that's like a tip of the iceberg. You can literally get your genetics mapped out and find out what foods you're allergic to, or what foods would be beneficial for you. And this is all coming down the pike. But, you know, eventually, you know, we're going to have to eat more fermented foods with prebiotics to feed our probiotics, take good probiotics. And I think it's going to even help the cardiovascular system. So, you know, that's sort of the direction I'm really headed.
Well, I totally concur with you about having a healthy gut, which is why I have such a concern, one of the concerns, about genetically modified foods. Because they're coming out with more and more studies, you know, about what these genetically modified foods do to our gut, you know, and the leaky gut and the permeability and all of that. So I think we're at the tip of the iceberg in discovering what some of these altered DNA foods can do to us. So I know that's a whole nother show, but I think you're spot on with that information, and I appreciate you saying that. Give us your websites again one more time, so
yeah,
our listeners can.
If people want to get information, and if they want to check out their cardiovascular risk and just get educated, HeartMDInstitute.com is a really solid informational website. I did that to balance my commercial website, which is drsinatra.com. I mean, some people just want the solution, you know. Just in other words, it's like an Amazon click, click. I just want the solution.
Right.
Other people need pages and pages of information. So it's just a balance. So, you know, drsinatra.com, although it has a lot of great information and a lot of videos, You know, I'm sort of a cooking cardiologist. I do a lot of videos on cooking. I do a lot of videos on healthy, you know, on my six pillars of healing. So there's a lot of good information out there. And especially if people are confused about what we talked about today, at least they can go to those websites and think for themselves and make their own decision.
Well, I think you've assisted us in understanding it and taken away some of the confusion with the new guidelines that, you know, regarding the statins. So thank you for that. And thank you very much, Dr. Sinatra, for being
okay,
a guest.
Okay, it was great. Great to talk to you, and maybe we'll do it again.
Yeah, and I just want to finish up by saying the book is The Great Cholesterol Myth and The Great Cholesterol Myth Cookbook. You can purchase these books anywhere, and soon we'll have a link on our site to these books. And thank you to our listeners, and remember to make healthy choices and be well.
Thanks so much.
Thank you. Bye-bye.